This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week we connect with a Sydney Riverman who's in Turkey to hear about his experiences during the recent deadly earthquake. A local cardiologist speaks from the heart to tell us how we can take better care of ourselves. If you need a good fix of hockey, don't worry, the Vinci is coming up, and we'll hear stories about ghosts, a former hospital that treated patients with tuberculosis, and a Sydney mayor who went to prison for murder. These stories are coming up on the Coast. Zach McQuaid of Sydney River crossed the Atlantic Ocean for the adventure of a lifetime, visiting several countries, meeting friends along the way. He was in Turkey during the earthquake, claiming the lives of thousands of people. Zach is okay and feels grateful, but incidentally, he feels a bit guilty for surviving, and he explains how the journey started.
I was working in Halifax for a few years, and I had the urge to go see the world before I really settled down too much in Halifax. And so I decided to basically sell all my stuff and buy a backpack and pack what I could in there and go traveling. So I traveled through, I started in Portugal and then worked my way through Western Europe and then did the Balkans and was through the United Kingdom. And after that, I ended up in Istanbul. From there, I met some other travelers, and we basically went on a road trip sort of through Turkey. Ended up in the southern part where the earthquakes hit. And then, where we're travelers, we're not totally connected to the local community. We talk to locals and as much as we can and make those connections. But no, as far as we, like all the locals we talked to, there was no warning at all. We were totally surprised. Like when we checked the clock, it was 4:19 a.m., but that was kind of after it started. So we woke up and our beds were shaking around, and there was all of the stuff in our room was shaking around and making a lot of noise. And then it shook us around for about a minute. And I had no idea what was going on, but one of my friends, he said that it was an earthquake, and we just kind of wrote it out. And then after that, there was some aftershocks. And there was one that was not as big as the first one, but we definitely felt them for the next probably 20 minutes. And then I didn't really think much of it. It was kind of like an ignorance is bliss situation. I didn't realize how big of an earthquake it was. And then, I fell asleep after that. And I think most of us did, except for one of us. He stayed up and was kind of monitoring what was going on. I've never even heard of an earthquake, really, like just on the news. And again, yeah, it was kind of like, I hadn't realized how serious it was until the next day. And then, we checked. The next day, we checked the news, and we saw the devastation, and we were just in shock, really. And we talked about getting out of there, but we kind of sat still for a bit. We went out to get some water and stuff, and that's when the second one hit. I was in a grocery store, and we were rushed out. And then at that point, we decided to leave. But yeah, really, we left town pretty quick. Like we were, if you think about it, the situation, me and my friends were about the luckiest people there, where it was easy for us to leave town. We had nothing really, like no family or homes to worry about. So we got out of there pretty quick, and there's all these people that have been literally like their lives have changed. And all of us have talked about how guilty we feel, and we talked about it, and like all of us have kind of been experiencing survivor's guilt, all in our own way, I guess. But I guess we've been supporting each other, and like Obviously, it's not our fault what happened, but still living through it, just it has an impact on you. So, we talked about, I guess, how we could help. So we're in Mardin now, which is about 300 kilometers east of the epicenter. And since we've been here, there's been, we feel safe. There's been some slight shaking, but we feel pretty safe. And we talked to some locals here about how we could help out. And like there was an urge for us to, like, we talked about going back, but I mean, none of us speak Turkish. We don't really have the skills, so I think we would just get in the way. But yeah, we talked to some locals, and they gave us some organizations we could donate to. And yeah, we did. We made a donation. But honestly, like, the, I don't know, it's a new feeling for us, just that guilty feeling, and we're still kind of dealing with it. And yeah, I guess something that could hopefully make me feel better is talking about the donations and having that air on the radio. And yeah, I mean, there's lots of places you can donate. It's always smart to do your own research. The local in Mardin, they gave us the name of an organization. It's AHBAP. And they're a local organization in Turkey, and that's the one that we donated to. So,
Zach, can you tell us about your group of friends? I understand you went abroad by yourself, and these are folks that you've met along the way. What would you like to say about them?
We've only really known each other for 2-3 weeks, but we're definitely, we feel very close now. Like, we had good chemistry when we met, and that's kind of how we decided to go on this journey together. I was really glad to have them with me here, and I think we've all done a pretty good job of supporting each other and just kind of figuring things out as we go, I guess. Even the day of especially the day of the earthquakes, it was really, like, I think it was a game changer to have them with me and to have each other to kind of support each other.
It's hard to imagine what your family back here in Sydney River, what their immediate reaction would be when they wake up in the morning and they see on social media or on the news that there was this devastating earthquake in Turkey, knowing that you were there. It could be a parent's worst nightmare. What was that conversation like with your family back here in Sydney?
It was kind of chaotic, I guess. Like, I tried to reach out to as many people as I could as it was happening. But we were in touch, but we were a little busy kind of dealing with getting out of town. I think the first conversation I had with my mom, I had to cut it short because there was a situation, I guess. when we finally got a taxi, we ended up at the bus station, and it was a little chaotic. And we quickly realized there was no buses that we could grab. So after that, we hopped in a taxi, and when we hopped in the taxi, there was a local Turkish man that hopped in the trunk, which we didn't really question, given the situation. And he was friendly too, so it was fine with us. But yeah, when my mom first called me, we had stopped at an unknown place to us, and they hopped out, and I just had to make sure that everything was okay, I guess. And that's when my mom first called me, and I told her I was safe, but I quickly had to say, oh, I gotta go, mom, I gotta deal with something. I quickly called her after that. But yeah, honestly, I feel like for my family, it was probably harder than it was for me, to be honest, because we were all in problem-solving mode, I guess, trying to get out of the city, and just like the endless endless things you could imagine about one of your loved ones being there. Must have been, it was very tough on them.
So, Isaac, just a bit on the geography there. I understand you're in a safe place as of now. You mentioned you were 300 kilometers east of where the epicenter of the earthquake was located.
So, about two days before the earthquake, we were in a town called Gaziantep, which is actually a pretty large city. It's like population's roughly 2 million or something. The center of, it's known for culinary or gastronomy. It's kind of the food center of Turkey. And that town, the epicenter, was very close to that town. And it was, it was devastated. And then after that, we went to Şanlıurfa. And that's where we were when the earthquakes hit. And then, so Şanlıurfa is about 150 kilometers east of Gaziantep. And then once everything went down, we grabbed that taxi, which took us to Mardin, which is 150 kilometers east of Şanlıurfa.
Maybe just another question or two, if you don't mind. What are your plans now? Does this tragic event, does this discourage your future travels?
I'm traveling with some pretty serious travelers. Like, I'm the baby of the group. I've been traveling now for 5 months. Some of the others they've been traveling now for 2 years. So we're all pretty seasoned travelers and we're used to chaos, but yeah, this is definitely, as far as, chaos goes and, things that cause emotion. This is probably hopefully the biggest thing all of us will experience on our travels. So the plan is to keep moving. We're going to head east to a city called Erbil, which is in northern Iraq. Today we have a new sense of gratefulness, I think. Tonight I sat up on the hill here in Mardin and watched the sunset on my own and just, I was feeling extremely grateful just to be there and be safe, really.
Well, all the best to you, young man. You and your friends, stay safe. I'm 26 years old. You've certainly experienced a lot. And of course, with your electrical engineering degree, best of luck, whatever you decide to do in your future endeavors. Is there anything you'd like to leave us with, Zach, or anything you'd like to mention that I haven't asked you?
I guess I'll just try and mention the donations again.
Yes.
There's lots of places you can donate, but it was AHBAP, and really any donation will help, and it can legitimately go to save lives. So, consider.
February is Heart Month. It's a time to bring attention to the importance of cardiovascular health and what we can do to reduce our risk of cardiovascular disease. And with that, we'd like to welcome one of the elite cardiologists at the Regional Hospital, Dr. Paul McDonald. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Looking at some of the stats online, and I was shocked to see that heart disease affects approximately 2.4 million Canadians and is the second leading cause of death in Canada. While that number is alarming, but this can be prevented, correct?
Absolutely. So most of the risk factors for cardiovascular disease we have control over. Certainly our biggest risk factor is smoking. We continue to struggle with high smoking rates in our community, and we see that as a big issue. Diabetes is another huge factor. And this is heavily influenced both by diet and exercise. Hypertension and cholesterol, we have excellent treatments for. So many of the features causing cardiovascular disease, we can control ourselves.
Age has something to do with it as well, and depending on whether you're a man or a woman?
Right. So the risk factors that are not modifiable would be your gender, your age, and your family history. But really, except for age, most of this is attributed to things that we can influence. And also highlighting that women have just as much heart disease as men, although they often present a bit differently.
When should we be concerned? What are some of these signs that we know that we should be concerned with the fact that I could have heart problems later down the road?
Well, and again, if you're carrying one of those risk factors, then you're at risk of both heart trouble, strokes, kidney failure, blindness, amputations, all of the circulatory issues. The symptoms that we worry about certainly with heart disease are chest pain and shortness of breath predominantly. And if you ideally are exercising regularly and you can go for an hour's walk a day, if you're getting chest pain or shortness of breath halfway through that, then that's your own stress test. And people have a much better sense of what their heart is able to do by regular exercising. So those are the classic signs, would be chest pain, shortness of breath, increasing fatigue, and then issues like swelling in your legs or feet, waking up at night short of breath, and also your heart racing or palpitations would be other causes for concern.
More and more people are eating out these days, and I guess everything in moderation is what I'm trying to say.
Well, in moderation, but also restaurants and have really made efforts to have very healthy selections. So you can choose restaurants that are that cater specifically to healthy foods, such as Freshie downtown. But you can also, in other restaurants in the community, there will be vegetarian selections, salads. So you can really focus on fruits and vegetables and avoiding heavier processed foods. But certainly there's a lot of salt in most restaurants you're eating out at, and most of the fast food traditional places would not be on your healthy cardiac diet.
So would it be safe to say if I followed the Canada Food Guide and with a diet and exercise, I should be okay?
It is. The Canada Food Guide has gone through major renovations, if you will. The previous food guide was heavily influenced by the dairy industry and beef farmers. So we have much less influence or recommendations that milk, for instance, is healthy. Fish is, and we have great access to fish in our community, but fishes are preferred over meats. Typically white meat may be healthier than red meat. Portion size is also very important, but more fruits and vegetables than meat. And again, things like nuts, olive oil, those things are also very healthy. And we have other opportunities in our community now with Indian restaurants, with Thai food, with Asian food, and greater diversity of other healthy choices. So I think there is opportunity to do better, certainly.
If I was to maybe, you know, hear this often on diets and stuff like that, a cheat night, so to speak. So would you encourage maybe once a week to eat what you like in moderation? What would you suggest?
I think we're always going to have some things where we're going to have a cheat night, if you will. My father always told me it's not what you eat between Christmas and New Year's, it's what you eat between New Year's and Christmas.
Okay.
So you can't have too many cheat nights. That's the issue. But you know, I think certainly, you know, once a week you can indulge a little bit and have something a little richer. But you really need to have a habit of buying healthier foods and cooking foods yourself and focusing on those things that we know are healthy.
Cook at home, and certain foods that you may think are healthy are not healthy, as you said. There's a lot of salt content, and that could drive up your blood pressure, and that's a whole other story altogether.
That can be a bit of work for us, yeah, certainly.
Is there some kind of guide other than the Canada Food Guide? Let's say I'm having some of those numbness in my face or maybe having problems breathing or heart palpitations. When should I actually pick up the phone or go to ER if I have any of those symptoms?
Yes, well, I'm glad you brought that up. I know that in the media, we've had so much bad press about trouble with our emergency departments, but I want to emphasize that we have an expert staff in our hospital, and there are thousands of patients who get very good treatment and are very satisfied. And so I think, although we certainly have had cases that have been catastrophic, but but you should not be afraid to come to the emergency department. And when COVID first became an active issue, we actually had people who had symptoms and they were afraid to come in and show up. So you shouldn't be afraid to come to the emergency room worried about wait lists or those challenges. If you come in and say you're having chest pain or you're worried about your heart, then you're going to get an EKG right away at the triage desk and very quickly be initially assessed. So certainly chest pain, shortness of breath, sweatiness, nausea and vomiting, that constellation of symptoms is something you would want to come in and get checked right away. And you may, in fact, want to call EHS and come in by an ambulance because they can do that EKG in your house. They can administer life-saving therapies in your home before you reach the hospital. And so there's certainly great opportunities there. And we have a fantastic EHS service in the province as well. If you're not sure, you can call 811 as well and get further advice over the phone.
And if you catch it early, that's going to make a dramatic outcome in the difference.
Time is muscle for your heart. Time is brain for your stroke risks. So it's very important to seek rapid attention if you have concerns with acute vascular injuries.
As you know, we have an older population here in the Cape Breton Island, and some may think, oh, it's just a muscle pain. If you have symptoms, go to the ER. I guess that's the best thing we could say?
Yeah. Even if I'm in your house with you, I don't know if your pain is heart pain or from your gallbladder or heartburn or what else it may be, unless you have an EKG and some blood tests and things, and you really want to let the experts take care of that.
So the old adage is better to be safe than sorry.
Better to be safe than sorry, absolutely.
Well, I appreciate your time. I know you're a very busy man looking after all kinds of roles at the regional hospital. And again, February is Heart Month, but we really should be thinking about this each and every day of our lives.
Absolutely. You want to take care of your heart for yourself and for your family and friends.
It's back again for another year. It's the Vince Ryan Memorial Hockey Tournament happening at rinks throughout Cape Breton. And the man that knows that best, Richie Warren. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
Now, Rich, you've been doing this for a long time with the Vince Ryan. Of course, a couple of blips on the radar with COVID, but back in full force this year, hoping to see a big crowd out and about because this is not just a fundraiser for scholarships for the Vince Ryan Memorial Hockey Tournament, but brings in so much money to the economy here in Cape Breton when it would typically be a slow time.
It is fabulous to be back. COVID 2 years, and we're sort of slowly getting back. Last year, we only took teams from Nova Scotia because of airline restrictions and that. And I was very pleased. We had 74 teams that came in.
That was great.
It was wonderful. And to see business they brought in to stores and business that they're hurting. They're still hurting. We want to help them and, of course, put good hockey down that the public can come out. We're pleased. We have a group coming in from New York. We have two teams from Ontario. We're slowly getting back, rebuilding, and I expect over 100 teams this year.
I remember a number of years ago when I chatted with you, at one point there was like 135 teams in 1 year. I don't know if we'll ever reach that ever again, but this is a tournament that's known worldwide. People come here, A, for the hockey, and for such friendly people here in Cape Breton Island. Not only do they play hockey, but they probably will come back in the summertime to visit again.
They do, and I know that because there are times I'll have a player and his family up knocking on my door and asking me where would be a nice place to go around Cape Breton, and I would tell them. I remember one year I took a couple up around the Cabot Trail, and that's Cape Breton hospitality in a nutshell.
And speaking about hospitality, we're reaching out for volunteers, and I know over the years, this tournament's been running a number of years, and like a lot of people, hurting for volunteers, whether the volunteers that they have for so many years maybe passed away, but looking to pass the torch. And if folks are listening to this right now, you're looking for volunteers for rink attendees, also for ticket sales, also the dance. Well, actually, there's two of them coming up, but also bartenders as well. Now, if folks are interested in volunteering and helping out in their community, and this is a thing not just happening in Glace Bay, the Minot Forum, it's happening all around Cape Breton Island. How can they go about contacting you or your office to volunteer?
They can call our office. There's an application for each volunteer to fill out. And what we want is on that application is to see what they would like to do. We don't want them selling 50-50 tickets if they don't like doing it. We want to put them where they would like it. Now, over on the north side, we lost a gentleman that run the rink for years, and right now I don't have anybody to run the Emerald Center for us for the tournament. And the Emerald Center is a key fixture for this tournament.
And Corey Keeping did some great work in the community, and I knew him very well. The type of guy that he said if he would do something for you, he would do it. Just an all-around community guy.
I agree 100%, and it was shocking when I heard about it. He was, as you said, he was a pure gentleman and great fellow to work with.
Now, folks are looking to volunteer. Like I said, you can go online to your Facebook page, Vincy Ryan Hockey Tournament, or you can give a call at 849-1133. You can talk to Helen or Lisa or yourself there and find out more information how they can help out. And we want to make this a successful tournament again this year. And like you said, for COVID restrictions last year, 74 teams, that's nothing to sneeze at. So we got over 100 this year, and it's all about community, Rich, because the end result is bringing people to Cape Breton Island and the hospitality and maybe get them to come back again, help out with, of course, the economy, which is typically a slow time, and raising money for scholarships for the Vincy Ryan. Now, how many scholarships do you usually give out after this tournament is done?
Well, generally, we try to give $1,000 to each high school in Cape Breton. And it depends on what our financial is. We have, over the 34 years now, have given over $1 million.
That's astounding.
And those students are our future. It's great over the years to see that when they're finished, we get an update and check on them to see what they're doing now with their careers.
Let's see if the circle can continue here. And moms and dads are maybe listening to this, or maybe students. Why not say this year is the year that I'm going to volunteer for the Vincy Ryan, because I know people that receive scholarships. That's what we need to do here around in the community, continue to support events like this. 34 years. I'm sure you can remember the very first one out contacting people to support this. We need more support to keep something like this going. And of course, the legacy of Vince Ryan continues on.
I agree, and we're hoping that people will pick up the phone and call us.
So again, we're starting up again on March 23rd through and through the 26th. Many rinks throughout Cape Breton. Big thing that we want to focus on, we need more volunteers. And if you can volunteer, you can give them a call at 849-1133. Talk to Lisa, Helen, or you can talk to yourself, Richie. Richie, really appreciate this. I know you got a lot of stuff going on here and out canvassing the community for sponsorship and stuff like that. And good luck on another great year for the Vincy Ryan.
Bill, I want to thank you for your time. And of course, Coastal Radio has been 100% behind the Vince Ryan tournament.
The Eldwig Art Center public lecture series continues through May, and one of the speakers so far is Jonathan Manley of Sydney. He's in his glory, surrounded by books and local history for his job at the library downtown. John is interested in ghost stories, too, from this area. He's a member and head researcher of the only paranormal investigation group on the island, Haunts from Cape Breton.
It's always just been something that I've been interested in. I think growing up, I thought that, you know, spooky, creepy things were too scary for me. And then later on, as I grew up, I started to watch a lot of horror movies and read a lot of books, and it kind of just went with that. But then also I have an interest in history, and specifically, you know, the history of the area we live in. And so the two kind of went hand in hand. And then when I started at the library, I made myself very familiar with our Nova Scotia collection, and often ended up finding really interesting facts about history, and sometimes a little bit morbid and a little bit dark. And but it kind of paved the way for me to be involved with the Haunts from the Cape group. So that's how I kind of ended up where I am.
Yes, and as far as the Haunts from the Cape group, very popular on YouTube. Can you tell us a little bit about that group, please? And what kind of work do you do?
So the group was started in 2014 by Jason Murphy and Doug Mombrickett. And I've always been friends with Jason, and we just kind of, when I started the library, it just kind of made sense that I would be able to research for them and kind of figure out, you know, why a place would be haunted, because Jason and Doug are both very interested in history as well, and not just the, you know, paranormal aspect of a place or the a person or anything like that.
And then, of course, you're invited to speak for a lecture series that's taking place here at the Eldwig Arts Center. And I had the pleasure of being in the audience the other night when you gave your lecture. I have some notes here, John, some very interesting points. I hope we'll get to cover most of them. But to get the ball rolling, in your opinion, why do you think this kind of paranormal activity occurs in the first place? And why is it possible? And what is the connection between something that would be described as a sighting in connection with the history of a particular community or location?
I think that's what I wanted to mention and wanted to make known most prominently with the lecture was the relationship between history and haunting. And like I said, sometimes it's not always a specific event, but it's just the sense of history and people using history to feel, or using hauntings, sorry, to feel closer to a place or an event. And so, because history as well as hauntings bring the stories and feelings and emotions of people and an area into the present. And I feel like that creates kind of like a ripple that we can all kind of feel in every area. So it's not always a specific event or, you know, a tragedy or a death or anything like that that brings about a haunting, but the history of a place and how people feel towards the history of a place.
John, if I can read a brief article here, mm-hmm. I'll try to be very quick with it, and then I'm sure you'll recognize it immediately, and then you can speak to it afterwards. But Mayor Dan Jack McLean was the 10th mayor of the city of Sydney from 1942 mm-hmm. to 49. He was forced to resign when mm-hmm. he was charged with the murder of the Register of Voters, Joe McKinnon, and yep. that death was on December 18th, 1949. He was 63 years old at the time and semi-crippled. There had just been an election in early December 1949 where mm-hmm. McLean had been reelected for a fifth two-year term. McKinnon mm-hmm. was found dead in a south end of a Sydney alley with his head badly cut mm-hmm. and his chest was crushed in. Can you tell me how this event was in relation to your work and why this was brought up during your lecture?
The reason I brought it up during the lecture was just kind of to show that I kind of have this weird blind luck when I go into researching that I always end up, regardless of what I'm researching, however innocuous it is, sometimes along the way, I usually find something like this, something a weird, tragic, or just sometimes strange event during history. So in this case, the reason I was researching this was I was looking through the annual reports for the city of Sydney for the year 1949. And just while I was skimming through the pages, a handwritten note fell out that just said, Mayor Jack McLean, murder, December 1949. And so anyways, I kind of ran with that and looked into it. And it was an interesting piece of history that a lot of people don't know about. So.
And it was about this time where you described maybe some of the science behind the people in groups like Ghosts from the Haunt, and someone with your experience as well, there's a bit of science involved where there's a change in temperature, an electromagnetic field. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more, please?
So for my perspective on this, I was coming at it more of a historical idea. But when I do travel with the Haunts from the Cape group, they do have a variety of different scientific devices that they would use, including an EMF meter, which registers electromagnetic fields in the area, REM pods. I'm blanking on what REM stands for, but basically it's a device that you would put down, and anything that disturbs the field that it gives off would set it off. Also a AM/FM scanner. It scans through the dead air on radios and radio signals. So it will pick up radio signals if you're in town or whatever, but if you're, like Jason always from Haunts from the Cape always likes to say, if you're standing in a graveyard in the middle of nowhere at 3 o'clock in the morning, you're not picking up a lot of radio stations. So there's also, like you said, the temperature changes in temperature. So they do carry thermometers that people would use for basically people who insulate houses, like the thermometers where you can point it at a surface and it'll tell you the temperature change and whatnot. And so you can check various temperatures at various locations. And just typical things like a recorder. Recently, we started using an SLS camera, which tracks body movement. And sometimes, so it will track a person that walks across in front of the camera, but it will also supposedly track anything that walks in front of the camera that we can't see.
If you don't mind, John, for anyone who's curious on that story that you told about the former mayor, Jack McLean, do you mind if I just read two or three more sentences to kind of,
sure,
in case anyone was wondering about the fate of the late mayor? So after the gentleman was found dead, Joseph McKinnon, there's just a couple more sentences here. Two local young people, they witnessed a car run over Mr. McKinnon two times. Mm-hmm. Then they seized the car that was owned by Mayor McLean. Joseph McKinnon had been to the McLean summer bungalow at Blackett's Lake with McLean the Sunday before on December 11th, 1949, for a drinking party. And then when he was arrested, he had a dislocated shoulder and he was put in the hospital on guard. He served 3 years in prison, by the way, for that. He was 58 years old. And there was another story that you told, and I don't like to put you on the spot, but I found it most interesting. I think a lot of people might be familiar with this area as well. Hospital Road in the Edwardsville area. What can you tell us about that sighting or that location as well, please?
The location is just a place that growing up in West Mountain Point Edward, I've always, walked through there. It was always interesting because it wasn't just a hike. It also had some interesting history about it. And so anyways, growing up, I know that we had gone further than where the path ends down Hospital Road, and it takes you out to the point where the old tuberculosis hospital in Sydney would have been during the early part of the 1900s. So it was just a place that I've always gone and not really experienced anything, but like growing up, I knew some of the history of it, and working at the library, we have a lot of resources, so it was interesting to see or hear more information about the place than what I knew growing up. So we have a lot of documents about the tuberculosis hospital, a lot of articles about it in our Nova Scotia collection. And it's mentioned quite frequently, again, in the annual reports of the City of Sydney, because they would have helped helping fund that place for people in the community to go and people outside of the community to go to either recover or to just be isolated for periods of time.
You were there with someone. You walked in the area and there was actually a physical reaction. Do you mind sharing that part as well?
Yeah, and again, this comes from the fact that all my stories are secondhand. I never actually have really experienced anything myself. So I took a friend for a walk to the area and didn't give them any indication as to what we were doing there or what I knew had gone on there. So I just took them into the area blind and we walked around the area where the old tuberculosis hospital would have been. And they suddenly said that they don't feel well. And I just asked, you know, why not? And we're in this, you know, beautiful place. It's the fall, so everything is really nice. And the leaves are changing and you can see across the harbor and the air is fresh and nice. And they just said, I don't feel well. I'm sick to my stomach. Can we head back? So we turned around and headed back and they started to feel better as we put some distance between us and the location. And that was when I broke it to them that I actually knew where we were and what had happened there in the past. And that prompted them to give me a little punch in the shoulder for for not being truthful with them. But I just wanted to see what would happen. And you go in blind to a place and I feel that's more indicative of what would be considered a haunting or a presence or a feeling or anything like that than just telling somebody ghost stories before you go to a place and then having them just say, oh yeah, I can feel the energy here, or I can feel the sadness or the pain or whatever, or the happiness or the joy or whatever the area has. But just to go into an area blind is kind of interesting too. So,
you mentioned that a lot of it is you're seeing this in secondhand situations. I think it was one of your peers who described you as the control when doing these types of investigations. What did you mean by that, John?
Coming at this from a purely historical is my usual interest in this. I come along for all the events for ghost tours and everything like that, but just seems like whenever I'm around, there's nothing happens. And to the point where I made I told the story of at the lecture series about when we had gone out to the Fortress of Louisbourg for the Great Louisbourg Sleepover in September. And anyways, there was a couple of locations that we were all investigating, but we were also doing tours with people that had come out to the fortress to either stay over or just see the fortress at night. And so there was a couple of locations, and apparently they had the organizers of the event had forgotten that I was in the Louisbourg Chapel. And so they left me there for 2 hours in the middle of the night in the pitch dark. And if you're familiar with the history of the chapel in Louisbourg, there are actually, when they were doing the excavations, the archaeological excavations of the area, they found five corpses under the floorboards of famous people that would have been involved in Louisbourg. I can't remember all the names off the top of my head, but I know the Duc d'Anville was one of them. And so they left me there for 2 hours next to these dead bodies, and I didn't experience anything. I just, Doug was joking around when he went back and listened to the recording. It was just me humming for 2 hours. So that's about all that happened there that night. So.
So, John, are you convinced that this type of phenomena occurs, that there is no logical explanation? If you haven't had these experiences firsthand yourself, it seems that you are convinced that it does, in fact, occur.
I like I said in my lecture, What I'm convinced of is not that there are ghosts and demons and whatnot surrounding us in these areas that we go to. I'm convinced, as Cassandra was too, that we're haunted by our history. We're haunted by events, regardless of how mundane they were, that have happened in the past. So you come to a place like even the McConnell Library, I mentioned in the lecture too, really has none of these scary, spooky stories that would surround it, that you'd think would make it haunted, like I said, with the mayor being murdered in an area, or a tragedy, or anything like that. But I feel like sometimes it's just the history of an area and the people that have moved through an area doing what you're doing right now, living their lives and just existing in a space. And because all these people have come before us, we feel a closeness and a connection and an empathy with the people that have come before us. And it just basically has this ripple in time almost that we can feel, and we can feel the energy of people that have come before us. So a place is not technically, to me anyways, haunted by ghosts and demons and mythological creatures, but history and experiences and just life in general.
John, you mentioned Cassandra, and if I can do so here as well, Cassandra Spooner Lockyer, who is your co-speaker at the lecture, by the way, a PhD candidate at the University of Toronto studying the ghostly landscapes of deindustrialized Cape Breton. She mm-hmm. has co-authored articles like Walking with a Ghost River, mm-hmm. and she used some terminology. She used references as the air, A-I-R, that type of air and atmosphere. And I found that very interesting. I never did hear that take or some an academic speaking to that. But did she basically mean that the air or the atmosphere is much like a canvas of energy or historical things that happen in a certain location? That's why there's remnants that will remain for decades and years later. Did I understand that correctly? It was a very interesting perspective.
It was, and I think that she just focuses on the importance of air, whether it be for breathing or it acting on the landscape of people that have come and gone before. She focused heavily on the tarpons and the open hearth park and whatnot, and how it is it was haunted by, not only history, but also, the particles of toxins and whatnot that would have been there many years after the steel plant closed and before it was converted into a park. So she made a lot of interesting points about also like ghosts being atmosphere and changing the air density of being there of an area, and the similarities between wind being just dense air, but also potentially the changes in the atmosphere being a ghostly remnant. And so I can't speak too much to what she said. It was a wonderful and different take on it, and I think that both of our lecturers worked really well together. So, because she brought up a lot of things that I was saying, and vice versa. So.
Those lectures worked very well together, coming from different points of view like that, but somehow there was some common ground there. And it's not on the Eldwig website as of yet, but I understand there will be a link there for the audio, and it's nearly 2 hours long from the lectures from both of you. So anyone who would like to hear that and have an interest in this field, check out the Eldwig Arts Center. You may find that lecture. And we only have a few minutes, John, but if I can put you on the spot one more time to there was a story, a visit that you made, I think it was in Victoria County, what's the name of that mill? Is it the Valley Mill?
We had that discussion, the places in Cape Breton having more than one name, and
right,
people hearing different stories about it from different people, and it kind of get some parts of it get lost because of that. So I could say I was talking about Blues Mills, which is what Blues I Mills. Heard it named as.
That's right.
But I had also heard it named as Valley Mills. So Blues Mills was the mill, and it was named after the individual who owned the property. And then Valley Mills Falls is the name that I've looked at, and it's Valley Mills Falls is the falls, I believe, that some other people had named it, but also it's called Blues Mills Falls. So one of those places in Cape Breton that's got two names and possibly even more. So,
yes. And would you mind quickly just describing the experience you had there with your friend?
So it was two friends. We just went for a hike. And again, it's in the middle, it's far from any, it's quite far from everywhere. You drive down several dirt roads in River Denny to get there, and you park at the end of an ATV trail. And as you wander into the woods, there's an old cabin in advanced state of decay. And inside, there's old religious texts and books and whatnot with hand-scrawled notes in the margin. So you already get this sense of history and abandonment there that comes with these places. So as we moved on to the ruins of the old mill, one of the people I was with started to say that they felt uncomfortable. And we moved on into the waterfall, which is absolutely gorgeous. And that was what we were there for. Took some pictures, had a rest and had a snack. And then on our way back, one of the individuals said that they'd seen somebody or something moving throughout the ruins of the old mill. So we left after that. Just we had finished our hike, and the two hiking companions were a little nervous, but I didn't really think much of it, again, being skeptical. And then when I was doing research a couple of weeks later, I found out that there had been a tragedy there in 1884, I believe. Yes, 1884. And where a person who had lived on the property, a small child of 10, had hid in a haystack from his brother, probably playing a game or whatever. And his older brother, not knowing that he was in the hay, began to mow the hay with a scythe. And the article that I found ends with, he's not expected to survive. And then there was nothing else afterwards. So it was, again, another situation where we had gone in blind, and two people had had experiences that I was with. And then we had kind of a tragedy or an event that would have backed up a typical haunting that people look for when they're looking for hauntings. But as I said, like an area doesn't need to have a tragedy or anything like that to be haunted, to feel those things. Full circle comes to was the, it was Broughton, was the people thought it was haunted. And people had said, you know, I feel something going through here, and, you know, I feel spirits, and I feel this, and I feel that. But there's nothing, none of those events that people like to look for with hauntings, like tragedy and death. So Broughton is kind of the place that I always come back to, saying, you know, it's a place that feels like it should be haunted, but I can find no real reason outside of people's experiences. And I'm not there to disprove people's experiences. So that's why I think that a place can be haunted by its history and its past and just mundane events going through day-to-day life. So,
John, if I ever find myself in the rare occasion that I have to go to the Fortress of Louisbourg in the middle of the night, I hope you'll come with me.
I'll try my best.
Thanks so much for your time today, sir, and it was very nice chatting with you.
All right, thank you very much.
That's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sunday at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m.
Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-284-NEWS. That's 902-284-6397. Or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcasts, available now online at coastalradio.ca.